Well, hello there, and a very warm but at the same time freezing cold welcome to this week's Guardian Technology Podcast. I'm Paul Carr, standing in for one very last time for Alex Krotowski before I let her out of my basement and deny any knowledge of how she ended up there. I'm joined this week, as ever, by the erudite Charles Arthur, who was this week included on an utterly ridiculous list of the, quote, 20 most visible people in UK technology. Charles apparently is visible from space, it turns out.
Also here, just the sun reflecting off my head.
Also here in the studio is the wise and witty Angus Banks, founder and CTO at news aggregating giant Moreover Technologies. Hello to you both. Charles, so how are you adjusting to your newfound fame?
Mostly by denying it. I mean, this list of 20, or possibly they went down to 100 or 1,000. I've no idea how far they went down.
It went to 20. What I loved is it went to 19, and then it's a click for more, and then your name appeared. No, that was 20. My favourite thing. It was like, oh, and Charles.
It's brilliant. It didn't have Jemima on it, and Jemima is surely
or Mike Butcher at TechCrunch UK.
It's just patently bonkers, bizarre, and
well, it was silly. A PR bullshit, wasn't it, really? Angus, you co-founded Moreover with Nick Denton, of course, who is also visible from space.
Of course.
And yet you...
Well, at least his ego, isn't it?
His head and his ego. And yet you shun the limelight yourself. Internet celebrity not appeal?
Well, I do have my own domain name,
of course, Paul, you do.
If that counts.
That does.
I am thinking of signing up for a Twitter account.
Well, according to that list, that's basically all you
need.
Well, I
have got
one,
but
I've used.
I'm still only a Facebook. I haven't gone that further.
Well, this is your chance to get followers. What's your Twitter name?
My Twitter name is Quagga.
Like the animal Quagga.
That's right, Paul. It's an extinct animal.
Didn't want to go with your actual name?
No, I feel an extinct animal is pretty good description.
Okay, then. Well, coming up on this week's show, if show is the right word for a podcast, I don't think anyone's sure, we have Jemima Kiss talking to YouTube's Director of Video Partnerships about fingerprinting technology and monetizing their content through ads. And Bobby Johnson meets Telnik's Justin Hayward to find out everything you ever wanted to know about the .tel domain name, but were afraid to ask. Plus, we'll be looking at this week's top technology stories and beating the crap out of some of the fascinating comments left on The Guardian's various tech-related blogs. It's going to be a blast. So if you even think about touching that dial, next week you'll be taking Alex's place in my basement. YouTube has been back in the news this week for its YouTube Live event, which brought together the various people whose careers have been made by the video sharing site. Everyone from Katy Perry, who I'm given to understand kissed a girl and liked it, but not in a gay way, to William Sled, the former Gap worker whose fashion video cast made him more popular than, well, someone who works in Gap. But when they're not organising self-congratulatory PR events or being sued by Viacom for copyright infringement, the Alpha video sharing site is actually doing some pretty impressive stuff behind the scenes. Our very own Jemima Kish caught up with Patrick Walker, YouTube's Director of Video Partnerships, to find out what was new.
We've always provided means by which rights holders can inform us of a content on YouTube they would like to have removed. That has in the past been a process that would include, say, sending us an email with a link to the video, or we have batch processing software and technology people could use. But what we've launched now with Video ID allows them to provide a video reference file, and then that reference file is in itself automatically matched against all the videos uploaded onto YouTube. And we get about 13 hours of video uploaded every minute. So a video reference file, let's say of a TV program or a music video, will, on a frame-by-frame basis, be matched against every video that's uploaded. And when a match is made, the rights holder can, in advance of any matches being made, set a business rule around what happens next. The choices could be to have that content automatically removed from the system and therefore never appear on the site. It could be to track it for marketing purposes just to see how the clip does. And it can be also to monetize it, meaning we run ads against that content.
Now, is this in response to requests from rights holders who want more content? I mean, I'm obviously aware that the Viacom case is sort of, hanging over Google and that's not resolved yet. Was this a product of that partly?
We've always had an ongoing commitment to copyright protection. It's part of an ongoing evolution of the tools. It wasn't like some snap decision, let's go do this based in reaction to anything. The whole idea behind it is to make the overall system easier to use and more intelligent, much more accessible to people, but it also is providing a very flexible way for them to apply different business models. This technology, though, takes a while to develop. Even in the last few months, we've moved from taking 8 hours to match an uploaded video relative to a reference file to 15 minutes, and it always gets shorter, and it gets faster, and it gets smarter.
It seems that there's been an increased demand for the service to be able to make money for people, or rather they've wanted to put ads on in the last 6 months. I mean, what specifically has happened in the last 6 months to the service that's made it more attractive to people? Is there an element of the economic downturn here and people looking to monetize as much as they can?
I think generally speaking, the industry is looking for new ways to generate income. They love the promotional opportunity. They love the ability to interact with users. But there is pressure on everyone these days to try and make these promotional and large-scale distribution opportunities, you know, new business opportunities, but always trying to balance it out with the right user experience. And so the tricky bit is to continuously provide new revenue opportunities and appropriate ad formats for the platform, while at the same time making YouTube a very fun and enjoyable and non-intrusive environment for video sharing.
What's the appeal for companies that are very particular about how they like their content to be presented? I mean, why have they suddenly had this change of heart and thought, well, you know, people that have uploaded, you know, bad quality copies of our stuff, we're suddenly going to let them do it and we're going to put adverts on? I mean, how much control do they really have over their stuff?
Well, they have full control. And it's funny, people use it in very different ways. There are those like Monty Python who are doing it in a way to say, okay, you win, we're going to put our stuff on now, officially onto YouTube, and we're going to run ads against it, and please click on our DVD links and buy our stuff. But at the same time, when they realize that by embracing content, they can actually increase the overall inventory quite considerably, that presents an even better commercial opportunity. In some partner cases, they tend to say, well, actually, okay, if this is what the users want, and they're quite happy with that version, then and we can run ads against it, then great. We've seen partners increase their overall view count, in some cases, 10x or even 100x.
How much money are partners really going to make through this, though? I mean, YouTube obviously has an enormous audience, and the way this system works, if there are, you know, 10 copies of the same clip, the publisher can claim all of those. But are we still just talking pennies?
It really depends. I mean, every individual rights holder has a different amount of content, different type of content that might have geo-restrictions in certain markets and not in other markets. And also, how much money is a lot of money really does vary by each publisher. It has to do with, you know, what it costs to clear the rights. It has to do with the cost of production. As people are moving, in some cases, with new types of content that's at a much lower production cost, the income looks pretty good to them right now. In terms of replacing slowly diminishing traditional revenue streams, not quite there yet, but they see an increase. They see a trend on a month-by-month basis of a growth in that revenue.
And how does this sort of platform sit alongside the growth of publishers' sort of proprietary video platforms? And obviously Hulu is doing really well in the States.
You can never possibly attract every potential customer to your site, and there's enormous marketing dollar needed if you ever did want to do so. And so more and more of them are pushing the content out to the edges where people gather. Then, you know, they can naturally, and should be, I would think, engaging and experimenting on lots of different platforms. And the experiences are also very different. So I may go to one website because they have high quality, long form download to buy or different sorts of engagement with content. But I go to YouTube to search, find, enjoy, share, comment, rate. And then maybe I'll link off to the broadcaster website to get a different experience or to go deeper or to look back at past episodes. They might use it for, you know, distribution to territories where they don't have any particular presence. So they might block their content in the UK because they have their own website, but then they'll use YouTube to distribute in Latin America, North America, and Asia. They might use it for research purposes, where they're getting a lot of data through our insight tools on what the demographics are, and then they use that for other purposes to support their businesses. And then there's the income opportunity. And these days, I don't think anyone really wants to commit to one stream of revenue. I think people have understood that non-exclusive is a good way to go, and being open and pushing your content out is a good way to go.
Well, thinking about how publishers are always looking for alternative revenue streams, it seems the click-to-buy system is the next logical step for YouTube. You recently introduced this in the US to some types of content, but can you explain that, and can you give us any indication of whether that might be launched in the UK soon?
Click-to-buy offers rights holders, in the short term, particularly the record labels, an ability to convert a free streamed video view on YouTube to a retail purchase on a download store like iTunes or through Amazon or others. On the page where the video is consumed, on YouTube, there's a link that says, if you'd like to buy this track, click here. And then it links through to the iTunes page or to Amazon page. We'll be launching that in Europe as well with other retailers. Because users consume media in different ways depending on where they are. YouTube is streaming, sit down, enjoy it, maybe send the link to your friend opportunity. But if you want to take that on the train with you and put it on your iPod or on your other MP3 device, you're going to want to go somewhere where you can own that content. So it's very complimentary. And we think this will be a good way to help support businesses beyond just through our ad rev share opportunity. And this doesn't apply just to music videos, but it applies to DVD sales. We're hoping to extend that over time to, say, ticket sales, merchandise. So it's just the beginning, I think, of a whole new type of revenue opportunity.
That was Patrick Walker there talking to Jemima Kish, or Jemima Kish talking to Patrick Walker, however you prefer. So YouTube then are obviously going with a policy of, or at least the rights owners are going with a policy of, if you can't beat them, monetize them. Now, is this a surrender by the rights owners, or is this forward thinking?
I think that if they were to kill off YouTube, it'd be rather like when they killed off Napster and everything just fragmented into places that they couldn't actually reach. Makes much more sense if you've got YouTube sitting there as this great big beast that everyone comes to look at stuff in. Yeah, why not make the money there? It's much. You only have to go to one place to get your money paid to you, and you know where everyone is. Much easier to get the stats.
Makes sense. Now, you were talking, Charles, about a piece you wrote for...
No, not me.
Kate Barkley. You didn't write it, sorry.
A couple of weeks ago, yes. Kate Barkley interviewed Gary Wang, who's the chief executive of Tudou, which is the Chinese equivalent of YouTube. Gets 12 million users a day, which might not sound much to you, but then again, you've got to consider that they're all Chinese, which is a country which has got a huge number of people going online, growing all the time. And the estimate there is that about 5% of the Tudou inventory is monetized, whereas YouTube has only got 3%. The thing with YouTube not having so much of its inventory monetized, so to speak, not being able to really generate some revenue from it, is that it costs a lot to run video servers. You know, even though prices are coming down, if your bandwidth uses are going up, which they are, then you've got to be able to pay for it somehow.
Now, what about this click-to-buy idea? I mean, this idea you can watch a stream thing, but then you can click to buy the download. Angus, would you pay to download something that you could watch for free on YouTube streaming?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, you can take the comparison of what we did pay for in normal news. I mean, there aren't very many subscription news sites, for example. So would you pay for video? I mean, yes, perhaps for a movie, but not necessarily for anything else. It's all a question of balance and height. I think actually very little will end up being paid for.
Yeah. The trouble with movies is people tend to watch them once and enjoy it, and then that's it. It's not got the same sort of lasting interest that a piece of music has. I mean, I'm still amazed, actually, the DVDs have been such a robust model through the years.
And finally, is it time for us to go to America and teach them how to pronounce Monty Python?
Oh, well, it's a difficult one, isn't it?
I mean, what is Monty Python? I mean, what is that? I don't even... none of them, honestly. I'm gonna do a lingua phone
course.
That's
Thomas Pynchon.
If all that talk of video sharing has whetted your appetite, then get yourself with all haste to The Guardian Tech's very own YouTube feed. Who knew we had one? At guardian.co.uk/technology/YouTube. And while you're off doing that, here's Charles with this week's news.
Twitter and Facebook held takeover talks in October, but those have now collapsed, according to a report by All Things D, the spin-off subsite of the Wall Street Journal. Facebook began the talks to buy Twitter in an all-stock deal that would have valued, sort of, the company at $500 million. However, as Facebook's stock isn't publicly traded, quite what the real value would have been is anyone's guess. Twitter is still a zero-revenue company, while Facebook generates millions in revenue and may even be profitable. Google has launched a major update to its search engine by allowing users to customize the results they get from running a query on the web. The new system, which is called SearchWiki, allows users to personalize the answers they get from running a web search by moving particular results up and down. They can also leave comments on any search result they find. Reuters has pulled its reporter out of Second Life. In a post on Silicon Alley Insider, Eric Krangel, who had the nom de deuxième vie Eric Reuters, said that the buzz is gone and that covering the beat was about as interesting as watching paint dry. Officials in California have unveiled ambitious plans to turn the San Francisco Bay Area, home to 7.6 million people, into one of the world's leading centers for electric vehicles. If it succeeds, the strategy will see billions of dollars poured into a power infrastructure that will turn the region away from fossil fuels and persuade millions of people to switch to green transport technology. Replacing around 1 million petrol cars with electric cars by 2015, as is proposed under the new plans, will make a big difference, probably to air traffic controllers watching all the pigs fly by.
Twitter, Facebook... what a dream team that would be. What a time-wasting dream team.
I can't understand. I mean, how would you... so many people already integrate the two.
Well, there's a widget, isn't it, that allows you to connect the two together. Yeah, I mean, well, as you say, Twitter at the moment, no revenue. Maybe it would be a good idea. They've had some management changes recently at Twitter. They're obviously... Times are changing. Maybe it is time.
Except they keep making noises about, well, no, we can come through this. We can do it. What we're going to do is expand the users. But actually, they've got plenty of users. They should really start thinking about some sort of monetization. And I'm very surprised they haven't. I mean, you could think of all sorts of ways of monetizing. You can have some sort of throttle on how many tweets you get for free. You have to pay some more if you want to do it properly, you know, to get more than, say, 5 an hour.
Yeah.
You could charge companies that provide software that interfaces to it directly through the API. You could charge...
I'd like to do phone voting, text message voting for people you want to vote off Twitter. So I would text every day just to get rid of, like, Scoble, or, you know, sometimes Jason Calacanis gets a little on my nerves. Maybe just vote him off for a day.
You've got a Simon Cowell complex, isn't it?
That's what it is, yeah. I want that. Angus, you realised during that last bit that you're not Quagga.
I'm not Quagga after all. No, I got confused with my Flickr account. I couldn't get Quagga on there.
Poor Quagga.
Someone else
now has
already taken the name of extinct.
That's
creature.
Right. Yeah, yeah, I know. It's an outrage. No. I mean, I'm a massive Facebook user, but not so much Twitter, as has become clear when I don't even know my
name. Twitter.
Yes, exactly. But Twitter's all about micro blogging, so I think they really need to look at what the bloggers are doing to earn money. And I think Twitter is just the next stage in blogging. It's just making everything micro. So I guess the next stage is micro ads that can be led onto that.
Micro payments. Micro tip jar where you can put in micro tips.
The key word is micro, I think. At this
for
point.
Me, I always sort of describe Twitter as being like Facebook status updates on crack. You know,
yeah. Well, they should sell crack, perhaps. Yes, I mean, that's certainly a proven monetary stream.
It is.
Just a suggestion. Not talking, of course, for the Guardian Tech podcast. And so the second exciting story this week, Second Life. I love Second Life.
Tell us what you did for it.
I co-wrote the unofficial tourist guide for Second Life.
Did you write it with a swarm of flying penises as your co-author?
I didn't have the choice. Somebody came in and drew them on there just to mess with me. If being on Second Life is like watching paint dry, certainly writing about it is like writing paint dry. But I mean, do you guys Second Life people?
No.
Never.
If Reuters had pulled out of, you know, Iraq, people care. When they pull out of, like, Zimbabwe, people go, ooh, times are hard. Pull out of Second Life, what? Who cares?
If Second Life collapsed over, you know, if it completely vanished off the face of the earth, you know, tonight, it might even have done this.
It's not even on the face of the earth. That's the whole point. It already has, doesn't ever existed on the face of the earth.
Would anyone notice? It's, you know, very much a tree in a forest, except it's not even a real tree. It's a virtual tree.
If Second Life takes ages to load and no one's there to bother, does anyone care?
What are the numbers of users on Second Life?
Three now. There were just three. There were those two people last week who
got divorced. One of them's on World of Warcraft now.
And there's the detective that found them out. That's it. And then there was Reuters writing about it going, what the hell has become of us? We used to be a proper news organization. Who are these losers? And that is the view of the Guardian Tech podcast. You can read all of these stories and so many more all day, every day, and to your heart's content at guardian.co.uk/technology. Now then, ICANN, the organisation responsible for approving new top-level domains, or TLDs if you like, has been on a sort of mass approval spree over the past few years, signing off on things like .eu for Eurosites, .mobi for mobile offerings, .name for personal homepages, and of course .brook for Charlie Brooker fan sites. And now we're about to see the launch of another one, .tel. Hurrah! But no, wait, come back. This one claims to be a bit different. In fact, it claims to be a new way of getting data to your phone. It's not a website, it's not an address book, but a contact directory over the internet. Bobby caught up with Justin Hayward of Telnic, the company sponsoring .tel, and asked what, in layman's terms, .tel actually is.
For individuals, it means an interactive business card, if you will, that you can provide to anybody, and depending on the relationship they have with you, they will see different contact information. For a business, .tel means a listing in a global directory that's, for the first time, mobile-optimized and accessible from any device connected to the internet.
So we're talking about a new form of address book entry that lives at, you know, bobbyjohnson.tel, rather than that on our website. What happens? Talk me through the process of getting information from there. What do I see and what do I have to do?
There are a number of different ways that you can actually access bobbyjohnson.tel, for example. The first is traditionally through a web browser, and that can be on your PC or it can be on a mobile phone. And because it has search engine optimization built in, you'll be able to search for Bobby, maybe using keywords like Guardian or some other hobby or interest that Bobby has, for example. In the future, we're also coming out with telpages.com, which will only search .tel domain names. We've also created applications for the iPhone, for BlackBerry, that plug directly into your address book. So in the future, if you're talking to your friend and they say, oh, by the way, my telephone number is, instead in the future they'll be able to say, oh, by the way, my .tel address is, and you'll be able to look that information up directly and dynamically from the DNS, the system behind the web, and it will always provide you current contact information. And then the third way is, in some countries, you'll be able to actually SMS for the .tel information.
So pick up my phone, type into it, you know, I want to call justin.tel, and it knows that I'm trying to contact you, and so it phones through to the number that's associated with you. How does it know who I am? How does it build a relationship between me and you in that case?
When you look that up on your browser, you'll have actionable click to connect information that will enable you to click on that, and then it will automatically dial it, and it will divert to the number that, or the email address or the piece of contact information that they would like you to use first and foremost.
So this is a kind of totally different way of using a domain. How did the idea come around in the first place, and how on earth did you persuade ICANN to do this over and above all the other stuff that it's proposing?
Telnic as an organisation saw that communications and the internet were going to converge. It's definitely not about web content, although you can obviously put links to web content in there because that's a form of communication. What it's about is focused on communications, taking the friction out of communications and very easily delivering that kind of information out to any device. It did take some time for some people to get their heads around, and so it was only in May 2006 that Telnic was finally awarded that contract. We feel that we're a fairly unique top-level domain within the community, one that provides a very unique service. It's the only top-level domain that doesn't allow you to host a website.
I mean, we've seen lots of new domains. Operation in mobile, there's .mobi. We've had lots of European domains, Asia-wide domains.
And travel.
Exactly. Yep. Is this just another attempt to get some money out of McDonald's and Coca-Cola and all the trademark owners?
If that was purely the case, we would have done that within 1 year, and we would be doing something very, very similar to what everybody else is, which is delivering web content.
If I want to go and buy a .tel, can I do it today? How are things developing?
Well, we're on a countdown of December the 3rd, and effectively on December the 3rd, trademark owners will have a two-month period to be able to buy their domains in advance of everybody else so that they can actually protect their brands and their IP. From February the 3rd next year, domains will go live, and on that date, anybody will be able to buy a .tel. It's first come, first served, no premium names, no auctions. Then they'll be able to go away and use it with all of the functionality and be up and running within 5 minutes.
That was Justin Hayward there of Telnic talking to our very own Bobby Johnson. And apparently there was a crazy organist in the background there.
Justin Hayward from the Moody Blues in the background.
I think maybe it was. Maybe exactly. Maybe there was a miscommunication. They invited both Justin Haywards. And the other one just thought, oh, I'll play the music. So yes, that's the last time he does an interview at Blackpool Pleasure Beach. Domains. Angus, you're our in-house right now domain enthusiast.
Enthusiast, that's right.
Just another, I mean, .tel sounds like an anachronism to me. Do we need that?
Has actually been around quite some time since it was actually approved by ICANN, and this is finally the launch of the product. No, I mean, I kind of like it. They're basically using the DNS record. You're basically sticking your phone number in, as opposed to the sort of the website address. You're kind of latching your phone number onto the DNS system. So, yes, it's good. I think it will work if the phones start building it in. The trouble is, at the moment, you will need an application to look up that phone number. I think it will certainly work for companies. And if you think with the phone number, you can think of geo. So, I want to go to that restaurant. Not only do I get their phone number, that they'll also give you the geo information as well. So I think you have to look beyond it just being a phone number system. I think it will work well for companies, but I think one of the issues for personal level is how is that secured? How do you
stop spammers
spamming getting the phone
Angus.
Number
.tel.
But I actually quite like it. I'll be interested to see how it pans out.
But you know the .name people quite well. Why couldn't someone, if in terms of personal use, why couldn't the .name, why couldn't this just be a feature? Why do we need .tel?
You're right, it could be a feature, but you have to be very specific when you pitch for your your contract on one of these top-level domains, as they're called. So, yes, anybody could in theory do it, but you would have to change. They're very strictly controlled. .name is more about your personal identity on the web.
I take that, but could, for example, someone not just build that functionality?
Yeah,
into...
I mean, you look at when you're playing iTunes, looking up record, for example, your CD name and the cover and whatever, that's just one big database. So, yes, in theory, you could have a very similar system plugged into your phone. You don't necessarily need the dot.
Am I the only one that likes phone numbers? I love phone numbers.
There's something romantic about a phone number. Well, for you, we're going to have a
telephone book. Isn't there something romantic about getting somebody's phone number? Who the hell is going to go into a bar, you see somebody, you think, hey, I'm going to get her .tel? That's hideous, isn't it?
I quite like it. I'm sorry, I quite like it.
It's because you're married, Angus. You don't need it. It's, to me, I just don't see the romance of getting a girl's .tel number. I mean, in fact, if they had one, I'd probably not want to talk to them. I'd see that as almost like a sort of a ruling out.
It doesn't rule out many people yet.
Yes, exactly. There's just Angus, apparently. Angus and I will never be. A yes or a no, Charles, will you be getting your .tel, or will you be sticking with your...
It's more of a sort of puzzled finger on the chin sort of look.
And Angus?
I think it's early days whether .tel will conquer this, but clearly someone needs to.
A fair point. And you can find out more about .tel if you wish to at telnic.com. Yay. That's right. The unmistakable excitement in my voice can only mean one thing. It's time for my very favourite thing, not just in the podcast, but the entire world. A look at the various hilarious, insightful and brilliant comments that haven't been left on The Guardian's various technology blogs this week. Charles, what have you stepped in as you wandered through the forums?
Well, Bobby started a thread last Friday, which was, what would you take off the internet? Which led to lots of responses, yes. There were a number of people who said Jack Schofield, which, come on, guys.
They're just pipe haters.
Then there were a number who said, take the porn off, because it'd be so interesting to see the people, confused by what happened to my recreation. But Fred, too, who is, as usual, the voice of reason, said, you could remove the three letters www from the start of most website URLs for starters. Can anyone think of anything as persistent that serves as little function? Although I think it must demonstrate some principle of how evolution struggles to get rid of its mistakes.
Well, I was amused by Jack. I don't want him removed from the internet because he he's our very own curmudgeon in residence. Post this week, he did a post this week reviewing Gmail's new themes, which are basically, it now looks, as he rightly pointed out, like old Hotmail. It's now cutesy, and you can have all these sort of cutesy graphics and backgrounds and see what sending mail looks like if you're a 10-year-old girl. So, of course, Wowzer 808 jumped in saying, I'm liking them. Unfortunately, his murdering of the present continuous stopped me from reading. So, sorry, Wowzer, I can't be helping but hating you. Fortunately, Ian L was able to pull me back, saying, I'm currently running the terminal theme. It's rubbish. I can't see anything as clearly, and it's a pointless gimmick. I love it so far, though. Thanks, Ian L. Finally, and it pains me to say this, Ernst Trom made a good point. He said it'd be better if they concentrate on making it work better. Gmail still lacks the ability to separate incorrectly grouped conversations or join ones that should be. To which Jack responded, that's absolutely true. We had products that did this stuff better 20 years ago, and they also showed threading in a much more useful way. He also says he still wants folders. Gmail has folders, so why won't Google let me use them? I don't know, Jack. He also says most of us like a bit of eye candy as well. Damn right, Jack. And might I say you're looking pretty damn hot with that pipe. If you'd like to help put the user into loser-generated content, then head over to guardian.co.uk/techweekly for links to our blogs, our Facebook group, Twitter, Flickr, and all that good stuff.
In Thursday's tech section with The Guardian, there's details on the Federation of Small Businesses' complaints over the heavy-handed ways some picture libraries are chasing up perceived debts for photos used on websites. It looks like Ordnance Survey is not going to be privatised. Instead, it looks like at least some of its maps will be given away free. Is this a victory for the Free Our Data campaign? Microsoft seems to have decided it's better to protect the world from spam bots than to make money. It's now giving away its anti-malware product after 2 years of trying to sell it. And the BlackBerry Storm is reviewed, and we find it's more of a squall. Our hands-on with a new touchscreen shows it's not as clever as the ads would suggest. It's all in Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
And so that's it for another week. Charles, what do the next 7 days have in store for you?
God, I have no idea. Reading the pre-budget report and combing through it to see if there's anything about Ordnance Survey.
We can always rely on you, Charles. Isn't it? Yeah. My word. Angus, I imagine you'll be thinking up new top-level domains that you can come up with.
Yeah, well, all this talk of .tel has got me enthusiastic.
It sounds like it.
Yes, because apparently you can now bid for a new top-level domain, anything you want.
Right.
.apple.
Can I be .paulcar?
You can be .paulcar, yes. And you to get your bid together, this doesn't actually guarantee it.
Tell everyone how to do this, because I think everyone will want to do this.
You need to contact
Wowzer 808 will want his own.
You need to contact ICANN, and you need to submit your $185,000 with your bid.
About £9.
And yes, no, it's much
more.
Oh,
it's a bit more than that now.
£180,000 now.
Yeah.
They will tell you in 3 years whether you've been successful. So I'll be going for that.
Quagga. Yeah. Oh, that may have already gone.
Yeah.
We've done this
again,
before.
I'm afraid it's extinct, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
Splendid. Well, that's my guest hosting duties over for the foreseeable future. It's just time now for me to unlock the cellar door and lead Alex back blinking into the world. I swear I thought the banging was just coming from the pipes. But don't worry, just because I'm not doing the podcast anymore doesn't mean you can't post anonymous comments complaining about my, and I'm quoting commenter Heckler Spray here, ego wanking of the highest order. You can check out my weekly Not Safe for Work column every Wednesday at guardian.co.uk/technology or visit my blog, bringingnothing.com, which also shows how you can follow me on Twitter. See YouTube, that's how you do self-promotion. Thanks, of course, to Charles Arthur, Jemima Kiss and Bobby Johnson for their trademark excellence, and to this week's interviewees, Patrick Walker and Justin Hayward, and to our special studio guest, domain name enthusiast Angus Banks. And on behalf of Alex and the team, we'll all see you next Tuesday.